welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 13th of February 2023, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, and we have loads of exciting news stories to get into today, as Real Britannia is our podcast where we specifically look at news that will be of interest to British nationalists. And of course, I do have with me today my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed. I've just spent a few days playing with some of my grandchildren, and it's been a very sort of invigorating process. And it's the sort of type of thing that gives you a lot of hope for the future.
And a lot of inspiration as well. That's who we're doing all this for, is for your grandchildren and the next generation and the next generation after that. That's what it means to be a nationalist. You say thank you to your ancestors by doing whatever you can to improve things for the next generation and their descendants. And one of the ways that we go about doing this is that we try to draw attention to things that we think are not conducive to society, things that are not conducive to the Indigenous Britons. And the way that we do that to draw attention to it is, of course, by having protests. And there's been lots of protests over the last month that Patriotic Alternative have been involved in. A very, very successful protest in Erskine in Scotland last weekend. There have been the protests in Leeds, protests in Hull, protests that have actually managed to get the refugees removed, or the fake refugees, because they're claiming asylum whilst coming here from France. And they've actually been removed from the hotels. And these protests have all been organised with the police. We've had a stage there. They've taken place during the day. There's been no violence whatsoever. It's been peaceful. I think one of the ones at Leeds, I think the Antifa tried to attack the one at Leeds, and the police managed to keep the protesters and the counter-protesters apart, apart from a small scuffle that took place there. Hundreds of people have been turning up to hear the PA message, and PA have been working alongside locals that are concerned about what's happening, because what tends to happen is the government will just move people into a hotel, and there'll be no consultation with the people that live in that area, no consultation with the local councillors. And it, obviously that upsets the people that are living there, especially if they've got homeless on the streets that aren't being put in hotels. You've got a case in Wales that's happening at the moment where the public in the village there, they wanted a medical centre to be built on the old school grounds. And they were told, no, you can't have a medical centre, even though they need one. And now they're going to turn the school grounds into migrant accommodation. And they say, oh, we have to do this because we can't keep them up in hotels. So they shouldn't be in hotels in the first place. And as I say, there's been these successful protests that have taken place. Now, over the weekend in Liverpool, there was a video that was put out last week. And the video was filmed by a schoolgirl. I believe people are saying that she is 15. And the video was of her being propositioned by an alleged refugee. And the alleged refugee was 25. And the schoolgirl in the video says that this is illegal in this country. You get sent to jail for doing this. And it's very difficult to actually hear what the alleged refugee is saying. Now, this upset a lot of people. And this took place in Liverpool. And the alleged refugees are all staying in the Knowsley Suites Hotel there. And there was a protest. And I heard about this on the Saturday night or the Friday night. And there were people that were sharing videos basically on social media. And what had happened is there was a police van that was on fire. There was rioting that was happening. And the first thing I thought was, well, who calls for a protest at 8 p.m. in the evening? Certainly not Patriotic Alternative. Patriotic Alternative had nothing whatsoever to do with this. And it looked very, very suspicious to me that this so-called protest against the refugees had suddenly turned very violent. And apparently or at least they were having a riot, setting fire to a police car. I don't know if anybody was beaten up. And then you had Care for Calais. What they were doing there, I do not understand. I thought they were in Calais, helping the people out there living in the camps there and helping them to break into Britain. But apparently the head for Care for Calais was also at this hotel, and she was tweeting out about how the far right had set fire to this van. And when you dig into this, you find out that it wasn't far right. It was the locals that were really upset at what had happened with this schoolgirl. That's what it was. And then, of course, the next day you get the newspapers talking about this, and they're saying, oh, it was all the far right. It wasn't the far right. I mean, this is Liverpool as well, which is probably the most left-wing city in the whole of Britain. There is no far right in Liverpool. What this was local people, working class people, that were upset at what had happened to this schoolgirl. Now, we don't know if a second group came in there and started setting fire to the van or what have you, because it does seem very suspicious to me that the police just left this van there, apparently for the people that were there to start smashing up. The next day, the news was out, and the first article that came out made allegations that it was a patriotic alternative protest. Straight away, Laura Towler wrote to them, said this was nothing to do with us, and they retracted that statement. But then they smeared all the people that were there, which was the locals, they smeared them all as being far right. Now, the article has now gone up in Breitbart, and Breitbart are alleging that Patriotic Alternative had something to do with it, and PA had nothing whatsoever to do with it. PA were involved in the Tate Gallery anti-drag queen story hour protest, which actually took place on the Saturday, which we'll talk about after this. So what we basically have, we have locals, an impromptu local protest against the behaviour of the alleged refugees propositioning a schoolgirl. And then what you end up having is a police van being left there, and somehow this police van gets smashed up and set fire to, and then that is now being blamed on the far right. And this is what I know about it so far. Max, you have some other information on this that you wanted to bring up, and some comments as well. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's something I didn't see until after it was over, from the point of view of the news. But I was contacted by somebody who actually was there, who could see what was happening, and their account of the event was that it was local people that had turned up to protest about the approach that had been made to this schoolgirl. That the demonstration initially was a completely lawful and peaceful demonstration, but then a second group of people arrived who apparently had got weapons in their cars, and who had got fireworks, etc., and who then began a violent assault on the police that were there and drove the police back away from the van. That the police had sort of come in, and this van was left isolated, surrounded by this second violent group, who the person that I spoke to, who was an eyewitness to what happened, said that these people looked like Antifa. And what he said was that they were wearing masks, that they obviously carried weapons, that they broke into the police van and set it on fire, and that the Antifa people also were going through the crowds looking for prominent nationalist activists. I didn't really find very many of them, but when they did find one or two people that they were aware of, that they then threatened them, and that there was a narrow escape made, which then meant that there was actually no violence between Antifa and any people that were there from the from any right-wing organisations. The people from the right-wing organisations just left because they didn't want to be involved in any violence. But it appears from the information that I've been given that it was Antifa that were the cause of all of the violence, and were the cause of the police van that was set on fire.
Yeah, the sort of people that just want to cause trouble and riot, basically, and what they've succeeded in doing with the help of the press, the journalists are then smearing the people that live there and saying that they're all far right. This has been helped by this woman from Care for Calais, who was in the hotel car park, and she sent out a message saying that this was far right, this was a far right protest, and it wasn't, it was the locals. And I've even seen the BBC interviewing somebody about this as well, and they they were saying, oh, this was the far right. But one interesting thing did come out of this BBC interview. She said the reason why they're being put up in hotels is that this started with COVID, basically. And they started putting them up in hotels because of this concern about COVID and because of this lockdown. And then since the end of lockdown, they have continued to put them in hotels. And of course, during the lockdown, they also put the homeless people that were on the streets, they also put them up in hotels. But now we haven't got our homeless being put up in hotels. We've basically got these asylum seekers. As I say, they're all fake asylum seekers because they come from France. And as far as I'm aware, the Patriotic Alternative protests are against the government. They're against the Home Office for dropping these asylum seekers off in all these local communities in hotels when we have our own homeless that need to be looked after. And also because these people come from, in mainly they come from places with a completely different culture to the culture that we have here, which leads to incidents like the one on video last week, where you have this 25-year-old non-European asylum seeker propositioning this young girl. So the protests are actually against the Home Office, but the way that the media are portraying it and the way that I've seen these MPs portraying it, they're saying that the PA protests are protests against the asylum seekers themselves, as if PA are trying to frighten the asylum seekers. And you'll see people, how terrible must these asylum seekers feel seeing this shock and horror? They've just come here for peace. Well, they're claiming they've come from a war zone, so they're probably used to seeing a lot more than people protesting. But the protest is not against the asylum seekers. The protest is against our government, because if our government didn't put them up in hotels, didn't let them stay in the country, and instead remove them to a safe other country, then they wouldn't be coming here in the first place. And you can't blame people for wanting a better life. You can't blame people for being economic migrants, thinking, well, if I move to Europe, if I can get over there, I can earn more money and I can send that back home to my family. That's not the people that we're protesting against. The people that we're protesting against are the ones that are facilitating that, that are allowing that to happen. And the end result of it is obviously the displacement of the indigenous British people. And we can see that from the census results. You know, they say, oh, this is a conspiracy theory that people are being replaced. Well, it's not replacement, it's displacement. You've got new people that are being brought in and they are displacing the people that were here before. And instead of being like Hungary, where they have brought in tax breaks and they're encouraging the Hungarians to breed more and produce more children, instead of doing that, our government seem to be committed to just importing other people groups as if they can be somehow a replacement for the indigenous British people. You know, the fault lies at the foot of the government, and that's who people are protesting against. But of course, the MPs will say, oh no, this is all about inciting hate against these poor migrants, as if that's going to do anything. How is that going to solve our problems? You know, inciting hatred against migrants, that's not going to solve our problems. That's not what the point of these protests is about. The point of these protests is to put pressure on local government and put pressure on the Home Office to do something about this. And as I say, they have worked. They worked in Leighton on Ouse. I think it worked in Hull. I think there's another place that it worked out as well. Maybe Dolgarrog in Wales. I mean, all these places have stopped putting the migrants up in the hotels because the pressure that was put on the local government. So these protests do work, but the way that they are portrayed in the mainstream media is that it's against the asylum seekers, that we somehow hate asylum seekers and we're protesting against them. We're somehow trying to scare them by protesting outside the hotel. And that's not the point of it at all. And you know, why would they be scared at people protesting the government? And also, you know, if they just want the best for the British people, then, you know, why would they be worried about this? The problem is that we have these cultural clashes. We have these differences between our culture. And again, you know, our government should understand that and should be wanting to protect us from that and should not be putting these people into dropping them off in these areas all around the country. Because the other thing is, and we've mentioned this before, they're talking about sharing the burden, and what they do is they look at a part of the country that is 99.9% white, and they say, oh well, look, they don't have any refugees there, so we'll put them in there. And of course, that causes a big culture shock. because you've got people that come from parts of the world where women are covered up completely, and they're suddenly seeing schoolgirls who have to wear school skirts, and they're not used to seeing this. They think that women that are dressed like that, or girls that are dressed like that, are looking for husbands or are prostitutes, and you end up with all these problems. And all of these problems could be avoided if we didn't just create this big magnet for economic migrants to come into Britain. And if they didn't have this idea that they're not going to get turned away, they wouldn't come here. Because that's the other side of it. If they get turned down for their asylum, they can still claim legal aid, and they can fight that, and they can end up staying here for 2 or 3 years. If they get put up in the hotel during that time, and then the government are saying, well, we've got to get them out of these hotels. Where do they put them after they come out from the hotels? That's right. They put them up in council houses, or they put them up in private accommodation. And again, it's the Home Office that foots the bill for the private accommodation. So until all of that stops, they're still going to want to come over here. You can't blame them for wanting to come over here. The people who are to blame for this are the government. And that's who these protests are drawing attention to. And that's why the media try to portray it the other way around. That's why they try to say, oh, you're protesting against the asylum seekers because you just hate them. You just hate the colour of their skin. That's what this is all about. And it's not. And they do that as a way to try and shut this down. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I think one of the things that people need to do is just to think about, for example, holidays. Most people, if they're going on holiday, that they would like to go somewhere completely different, so that they so they have the opportunity of experiencing a different culture. Very often people will go to Scandinavia, sometimes they go to southern Europe, to Spain, to Italy, to Greece, to Albania, to Croatia, places of this sort that have got much warmer climates than we have, that have got a different sort of culture. And they go there because they actually like to experience those kind of different cultures, just not necessarily on a permanent basis, but on a temporary basis, because it creates variety and it gives them something of interest that they can enjoy, etc. So it's entirely wrong for the left to try and portray our countries or our nations' unhappiness with the forced multiculturalization and forced multiracialism that's being sort of impressed upon us, to portray that as being us hating other people. We don't hate other people because when we've got the chance, when we've got a bit of bonus money and we're going to go on holiday, we very often will go to other people's countries and we'll enjoy experiencing their culture. What we don't want is for our country, our homeland that we then return to be transformed, and for our people to be oppressed to such an extent that our young people can no longer afford to have families, can barely afford to buy a house. And where that is then having the effect that it's shrinking our numbers, and where bogus asylum seekers are then allowed to come to our country and to effectively, as you say, displace and replace the native population. That's what people don't want. You know, we're quite happy to engage with people who are of a different sort of ethnicity. We're quite happy to engage with people who have a different sort of cultural background. But we want that to be something which is in addition to the life that we have here at home. And we want that to be something special that we do when we go on holiday. And so you're absolutely right. You know, there's no sort of hatred behind it. There is just a wish not to have, as I say, multiculturalism and multiracialism forced upon us to such an extent that it effectively creates a kind of low-grade genocide of the indigenous people.
Well, again, another thing they talk about is they talk about, oh, you're just trying to divide us. But the people that are dividing us are the government by importing these completely different people groups and putting them within our own people groups. That's the division. You know, what they call diversity isn't diversity at all. It's trying to make a monoculture out of everybody. It's trying to turn everybody into consumers and get people to forget their identity and just take their identity from the things that they purchase or the football teams that they have. And they want everywhere to be the same. They want everywhere to have these corporations, these McDonald's everywhere. And this uniculture is the idea that they want of everybody being consumers. And that's not diversity. And the way they do that is to divide communities by bringing in these other groups. And I noticed that in this demonstration that took place in Scotland, there were some Scots MPs calling for Patriotic Alternative to be investigated. And this one MP was saying, well, she stands or he stands in solidarity with these refugees against the so-called far right. And what they're effectively saying is, well, I stand in solidarity with this group here, which isn't my actual group. This is another ethnic group. And I stand in solidarity with them against my own ethnic group. So they're effectively saying, I support this other family. Their interests come above the interests of my own family. And that's the lunacy that is in all of this. And I had somebody that came in the Radio Albion chat room after this Erskine demo, and they were obviously left wing, and they were saying, what do you think? This was a great failure, this Erskine demo. There was more of us than there were of you. And I was like, well, it's not a failure, because if the protest goes off without violence, then it's a success. If the protest gets to draw attention to the problem that's being highlighted, that's a success. So that demo was a success. And they were like, well, there's more of us than you. And I was like, well, you're funded by the unions. You have all the might of the mainstream media behind you. So you're not going to really expect anything else. And then they were saying, don't you just hate people because of the color of their skin? And I was like, it's not about hating people. It's about having love for your own family. And that's all it is. You look after the interests of your own family. They have to come first. Once your own family are okay and they have everything that they need, and you don't have any homeless, and they're all employed and they're all content, then you can go and help some of these other families. But you have to put the needs of your own people first, because nobody else is going to do that. If we don't do that, and our representatives in government do not put our interests first, nobody else is going to do that. They're not going to start putting our interests first in Africa or in India or in Pakistan. And the ethnic groups from those countries that are within our country, they're not going to put our interests first either. You know, they're going to be quite sensible and put their own interests first, which is what they should be doing. The problem is with white people or people of European ethnicity that are not thinking of ourselves as a group, and we're not putting the interests of the group first. And the people that are worst at this, you know, it's these politicians, the very people that have been put in power to govern things and to do things that are supposedly for the best needs of the people. They're not doing that. They've transferred their loyalty to this virtue signaling of look how good I am. I'm doing everything that I can to help this other people over here. And yes, it is good to help other people, but you have to help yourself first. It's no good being a lifesaver and you see somebody struggling and then you dive in to save them and the water's too deep or the water's freezing cold or you haven't got the strength to go and save them. I mean, you end up losing your life. And they end up losing their life. That's first rule of life saving. It's the same with this. You have to look after your own people first. Charity begins at home. And once everybody is fine, then you can go and help these other groups. And it is just common sense. And that's what I think people are trying to say in these protests. And that's what the locals say as well, because, you know, at this protest in Hull, in Leeds, Erskine, it's all local people, and Patriotic Alternative have come to the local people and said, look, we can help you out. We have knowledge of doing this. We can get you a stage. We can get you a sound system. We know how to do these things. We know how to draw attention to it, get the attention in the press. And the locals are saying, yes, we'll go along with that. And of course, we're saying to them, be prepared. You're going to be called a Nazi. You're going to be called a racist. You're going to be called all the names under the sun for working with us. And all credit to them, the people in Leeds, Hull and in Erskine, that they have worked with Patriotic Alternative. And this group that called for this protest in Liverpool, that were the locals that did that, they're now understanding what's going on here, because they've all been mischaracterized as the far right. And one thing Liverpool is not is far right. And I really don't think that any of the people living in that area probably have so-called far right sympathies, but that's what they've all been smeared as. It's
Liverpool's been referred to as the red city in the past, isn't it? Because they have so many people there who have been described at various times, rightly or wrongly, as being extreme left wing, I can remember during the sort of 80s when there was a lot of union activity, when there were lots of militant socialists in government in Liverpool, where, you know, it was regarded as being an almost ungovernable city because there were so many rebellious left-wing people that were prominent in their society at that time. So, yeah, I think what you're saying is absolutely correct.
Well, we also had this other protest that took place on the Saturday at the Tate Gallery, and that was against Ada HD, the drag queen, that wanted to do a drag queen story hour. Like, what adult entertainers should be having to do with three-year-olds and four-year-olds is anybody's guess. It was taking place at a library. And again, there was a big protest there. Lots of concerned families, lots of concerned parents. Patriotic Alternative were there. There are some good pictures of young Wesley in the Daily Mail walking along there with a patriotic crew behind him, with all their banners and flags. It looked very, very impressive, actually. And also, the good thing about these protesting these drag queen story hour, or protesting it, is that the mainstream media tend to give us more sympathetic coverage, because a lot of people support protesting against this. People do not want to see adult entertainers, homosexual adult entertainers, reading to children. They don't want the boundaries to be broken between adult sexual entertainment and toddlers. You know, that is a boundary that should be there. What do you end up with? You end up with kids looking up these drag queens on social media, and they end up seeing all this vile information that's there. You've then got the worry that kids will then be attracted to drag queens when they see drag queens. And of course, when it's not in that environment, again, it's going to be adult sexual entertainment. And the most suspicious thing about all of this is that libraries never used to pay for people to come into the library and speak to children, or read books to children. That was just unheard of. And now you've got these libraries that are actually paying drag queens to talk to children. It's very, very suspicious. And this Ada HD, that's the one that was doing this drag queen story hour. Patriotic Alternative were protesting against them last summer, and ended up getting quite a few of the drag queen story hours shut down. I think this one actually went ahead at the weekend at the Tate Gallery, but there were massive protests outside. And this Ada HD, they recently sent out a tweet because there was a drag queen in Cardiff that ended up losing their life. And they sent out tweets of support. And this drag queen that lost their life, they had a criminal record for child abuse. And then you've got this Ada HD who is reading to kids in libraries. They're tweeting out their support for them. They've also put out tweets saying, like, love has no age, which is a catchphrase of pedophiles. They've sent out tweets showing a young boy with somebody much, much older, and then said, oh, this is a great thing about gay clubs. Love has no age again. So, you know, this borderline pedophilia support is going on there. And yet you've still got this drag queen, which is going to these libraries. There was another protest against them in the southwest, I think, which took place last week, and I think they had to move the drag queen story hour from one premises to another premises. People were saying, did it get shut down? I think people did think that they had a success and it was shut down, but the drag queen has tweeted that it took place but at another premises. So we are having success with these protests. It draws attention to these issues, and it lets the public know that there are people out there that have got their best interests at heart. And the Patriotic Alternative are not just concerned about the replacement of our people, the demographic replacement of our people in Britain, but we're also concerned about the scandalising of children, the sexualising of children, giving children adult sexual entertainers as role models, all of these sorts of things as well. We're getting more and more public support for these issues. As I say, January up to February was just such a busy month with all these protests. And now in February as well, as I say, that this Erskine protest. And, that, you know, that's what makes me suspicious about this police van that was just left there in Liverpool. It's as if that they could just say, well, look, if they have this so-called far-right protest, there's going to be violence, there's going to be police van set on fire. We have to have new laws to deal with this. We have to stop the people from protesting. And it gives them an excuse to just smear the so-called far right. So I'm very, very suspicious of that. And also with the timing of it, with this report that's just come out about Prevent, which says that Islamism is the main threat. And the resources of Prevent need to be concentrated on Islamic extremism. And it's been concentrated on the so-called far right for too long. And that's what this report is going to say. So just at the time this report comes out, you then have this protest in Liverpool that takes place at night, not during the day. And then you get this police van that's set fire to. And the former Crown Prosecutor was tweeting this out and saying, look at how stupid these Prevent investigators are. Obviously, it's the far right that are the biggest threat. Just look at this violence and this riot that's taken place in Liverpool. So it's very suspicious that we have a coincidence there. And we probably haven't got time to take a look at this Prevent report now, Max. But yeah, any thoughts on Drag Queen Story Hour and the rest of these protests?
Well, I just look back at my youth to a time when drag queens were virtually unheard of, when people questioning their sexuality was unheard of. You know, if a boy at school, when I was a schoolboy, put his hand up and said, you know, please, miss or whatever, I'd like to be called Mary from now on because I'm transitioning to be a girl, that boy would have just been laughed at by so many people that they would have sort of never done that again, and it, because the whole idea is preposterous that a child who's never experienced adult sexuality, either female adult sexuality or even male adult sexuality, should at a pre-sexual age have decided that they want to change their sexuality. The whole idea is just absurd in my view, and the point is that at the same time that we're having these drag queens being foisted upon us to do these kind of readings and things, we've got campaigns in schools where teachers are being effectively browbeaten into presenting all of this transsexualism to their children. And if they refuse to use that kind of content in their lessons, and if they refuse to acknowledge that Johnny now wants to be called Mary, they get bullied out of their jobs and they end up having their careers ruined by extremist activists amongst the LGBTQII plus community. It's getting longer and longer and longer. It'll be, you know, some, perhaps 50 syllables before another year is out, that sort of designation. But anyway, you know, that they get attacked by militant campaigners from that sort of group, and it's all just absurd. It's just totally and utterly preposterous that this sort of thing is taking place.
Well, I think it's the law that says that they have to do this and they have to affirm somebody's presented gender. But that's not the law. That's what the activist organisations say. Kebby Badenoch, who looked into this last year, said that schools should not be socially transitioning children. Schools should be referring to children by what it says on their birth certificate. And until someone can change their birth certificate, they should be referred to as the gender that it says on there. Yet you have these schools that have been doing that. And the reason why they've been doing it is because of these activist organizations. And they get the activist organizations in because in order to comply with equality law and to understand about these issues, they need to get an expert in. And the experts that are known as being the experts are all activist organizations. So it just ends up going round and round in circles. But there is some good news on the horizon. Apparently, the Department of Education are going to produce some guidance on on the way that the schools should be dealing with this. And there is concern because when talking about this, they have referred to trans children as if children can actually know that they want to go on this pathway to being the opposite gender without actually, as you pointed out there, Max, without actually having gone through puberty. So there is some concern there. But there is also people that are saying, you know, well, they are going to be sensible in this and they have to actually give out this guidance. And the previous guidance that they gave out before was, as I say, was Kemi Badenoch. And she also said that if these schools continue to do this, parents need to take the school to court. And there is a teacher that is taking a school to court because he lost his job for refusing to refer to a so-called transgender pupil by their preferred gender pronouns. And he refused to do that and he lost his job. So he's now taking them to court over that. And as I say, there does seem to be public support for this. And you do tend to get sympathetic write-ups about these issues, drag queen story hour, and the trans issue in schools. And it's quite surprising, really, because there's also support for it amongst the radical feminists. And I never thought we would see something where radical feminists and people on the so-called right nationalists would be agreeing on something. But we do. We agree with these radical feminists on a lot of these issues as far as transgender and drag queens are concerned. It's not something that should be around children. And there's a lot of concern about that, and a lot of support for people that do go out and protest against it. So, you know, there is a good side to this as well. Well, shall we get into our greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yes, let's talk about something positive.
Yeah, let's talk about Sir Oswald Mosley, and we're going to move into the fascist era now with him as well. After his election failure in 1931, Mosley went on a study tour of the new movements of Italy's Benito Mussolini and other fascists, and he returned convinced, particularly by fascist Italy's economic programme, that it was the way forward for Britain. He was determined to unite the existing fascist movements and created the British Union of Fascists, the BUF, in 1932. And the BUF was protectionist, strongly anti-communist and nationalistic to the point of advocating authoritarianism. He claimed that the UK Labour Party was pursuing policies of international socialism, while fascism's aim was national socialism. It claimed a membership as high as 50,000 and had the Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror amongst its earliest supporters. The Mirror piece was a guest article by the Daily Mail owner Viscount Rothermere and an apparent one-off. But despite these briefly warm words for the BUF, the paper was so vitriolic in its condemnation of European fascism that National Socialist Germany added the newspaper's directors to a supposed hit list in the event of a successful Operation Sea Lion. The Mail continued to support the British Union of Fascists until the Olympia rally in June 1934. So it looks to me as if the main reason why he wanted to support fascism was because of the similarity that the fascist economic policy had to Mosley's memorandum. And also you had we were seeing lots of awful things happening in these Soviet countries, in Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. And also, when you think the state that Britain was in with the recession, the problems that the country had, he may have been looking at that and thinking, well, you need to have a strong authoritarian in order to sort this mess out. And we also need something new. So the British Union of Fascists was something new, and it had masses of support here at the time. And clearly, Mosley wasn't just being taken in by something. You know, he'd already been in the Conservative Party, and he'd been a very good politician. He'd already been in the Labour Party, and he decided that both of those were not going to work. But this new idea, which was really an old idea, everybody working together as one, as we pointed out before, with a symbol of the fasci, this new old idea may be the one that works. So he set up the British Union of Fascists in line with the fascist movements in Europe. You also had, obviously, fascism in Italy. You had Leon de Grel's movement, the Rexists in France. You had the Iron Guard in Romania. You had other groups in Croatia. You had various nationalist organizations that also had links with fascism. So I guess you could really say fascism was the overall term to describe these movements, but each one of them was slightly different. You think the National Socialists in Germany, the Iron Guard in Romania, all of them were slightly different, but all of them were about doing what's best for the nation, doing what's best for the country, and doing things in a different way to the communist way or the capitalist way that had been done before. Max, any thoughts on this?
Well, I think that as far as authoritarianism is one thing you've mentioned, authoritarianism is very often looked at as if it's something which is innately evil by leftists and by liberals. Authoritarianism, though, isn't necessarily an evil thing and the most obvious example there is if you're in a situation where decisions need to be made quickly and where people's lives and their livelihoods are going to depend upon decisions being made quickly, then you do need to have an authoritarian government, in the same way that you do need to have an authoritarian command system in a military organization, because otherwise you can't have generals getting together as a committee and making decisions on a committee basis if decisions need to be made quickly and need to be made decisively. You need people at key positions in an organization who've got the ability to make decisions. It's also a matter that, particularly with modern day societies have become very complicated. We very often talk about the issues with regard to fractional reserve banking and things of this sort, which are very technical, and it's not everybody's cup of tea to sort of research what these things mean and whether fractional reserve banking is good for the country or not. You also get people who sort of talk about raising GDP and other people who question whether it's GDP we should be focused on or whether it is GDP per capita that should be focused on. And again, these are like technical issues that don't tend to interest the vast majority of people. It's very rare that you'll have a conversation break out in a coffee shop or a tea shop where people will start to discuss the differences between these things. And that's largely because it either doesn't interest people or it is too academic and more academic than they want to wrestle with at that particular point in time. And so what you need very often are people who are prepared to decide what is the best thing for a nation. And that then means that you've got to have people who are expert or knowledgeable in a particular field making decisions on behalf of those people who either aren't inclined to study a particular area which is vital for the life of the nation, or don't actually have the academic ability to understand the principles involved in that particular area of academic pursuit. So it's quite understandable that Mosley adopted a more authoritarian position, and as I say, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything essentially wrong with that. It's just a different way of creating government, a different way of deciding the way in which nations should be governed, and the proof of the pudding really is in the eating, and that's. Yeah, that's pretty much all I've got to say on what you've said so far.
Well, I think authoritarianism, isn't it? I mean, it has a root in the monarchy, doesn't it? You would have like a king that was responsible for things. It was one guy at the top that would make these decisions. What he said had to be done. And you could then have one person to blame if things went wrong as well. I mean, it just seems sensible that you would have one person at the top who would be responsible for everything. And instead of having this vertical hierarchy, what we now tend to have is this horizontal thing where everybody's equal and you can chop and change and move things around. And it really doesn't matter. If you've got somebody that's the head of prisons one day, you can just change them around and put them as the head of the economy the next day. And you can change them around so that they're running the NHS on the next day, as if they're just movable pieces. Whereas I think with fascism, the idea was you would have somebody who was an expert in his field, and he would be responsible for that field. So you would end up with the people that were the very best at doing things, that were running things. And you had this guild system as well, which was the system that we had in the Middle Ages, which worked like that. And if you were involved in a trade, you had a guild, and you basically you all worked together within that guild to do what was best for that particular trade. It was a different way of doing things than having trade unions, because it meant that the bosses were working with the workers. You were all a part of that guild, and you were doing what was best for that guild. So that was a part of this as well. And then you had this corporatism that we mentioned last week that eventually grew out of a Catholic movement. And then you had fascism, which brought all these strands together. And you had a particularly ethnicity-based fascism in Germany with the National Socialism, and Italy, it wasn't so ethnicity conscious, it wasn't so race conscious, rather, in Italy. And there were different strands of thought within Britain at the time as well. Mosley was seen as not as extreme as he could be, I guess is the way that you could put it. And there were factions within the BUF that were saying that Mosley needed to be much harder in his rhetoric. And there was there were actually splits in the party, and one of those gets mentioned here. John Gunter described Mosley in 1940 as strikingly handsome. He is probably the best orator in England, and his personal magnetism is very great. So we have a very positive review there. Among Mosley's supporters at this time included John Strachey, the novelist Henry Williamson, military theorist J.F.C. Fuller, and the future Lord Haw-Haw, William Joyce. And William Joyce was one of the ones that actually left the British Union of Fascists and tried to start up his own organisation. And there was another author as well, quite a famous author or publisher. And he was the one that also helped out Colin Jordan later on. He was Colin Jordan's mentor. Do you know who I'm thinking of here, Max?
I think I do, but I just can't
Arnold
remember
Leese. The person's... Arnold Leese, isn't it?
Arnold Leese. Oh, yes. Yeah. Arnold Leese had the Imperial Fascist League.
Yeah, Arnold Leese and William Joyce, they had differences in agreement in how the British Union of Fascists should be run. So they had their own organisation. And obviously, William Joyce ended up going off to Germany and running the radio station over there. And he eventually got hanged on his way back after the war, which was, you know, he was tried for treason, and yet he actually had an American passport. Yet he was tried for treason in Britain. So he had lots of support at the time. Oswald Mosley did have lots of support at the time, but there were different factions that wanted things to be done in a different way. I guess Mosley wanted to do things more in the way of Mussolini, whereas William Joyce and his faction wanted to do things more in the way of Adolf Hitler. And Mosley had found problems with disruption of his new party meetings and instituted a corps of black uniformed paramilitary stewards, the Fascist Defence Force, nicknamed the Black Shirts, just like the Italian fascist voluntary militia for national security that they were emulating. And this is because you had these communists, anti-fascists, anarchists that would try to break up meetings, that would physically attack protests. The party was frequently involved in violent confrontations and riots, particularly with communist and Jewish groups attacking their meetings, and especially in London. And today they will lionize these groups as if they were wonderful people and they were fighting for democracy. But in actual fact, they were incredibly violent people that would just attack anybody who was supporting fascism. Extremely violent people. At a large Mosley rally at Olympia on the 7th of June 1934, his bodyguard's violence caused bad publicity. But why would his bodyguards have to use violence if he hadn't been attacked? I mean, that was the reason why they had this this security there, is because people would try to physically shut down the meetings and shut down free speech. This violence and the Night of the Long Knives in Germany led to negative publicity. And again, the Night of the Long Knives in Germany, that was between two different factions in National Socialism. There was one faction that was going to take over And they basically offed them all. That's as much as I know about the Night of the Long Knives. Do you know much about Night of the Long Knives in Germany, Max?
Night of the Long Knives was an occasion where Hitler really stamped his authority on the NSDAP, the Nazi Party in Germany. And it was a night where a lot of old grudges were settled effectively in Hitler's favour, where Hitler had arranged for Ernst Röhm, who had been the leader of the Sturm Abteilung, I think they were called, and he had him executed during the night of the Long Knives, together with other people who had been prominent members of the NSDAP who had opposed Hitler's direction, effectively.
And there was a big concern at the time that these people were being funded by communists as well, and that would lead to the failure of this National Socialist movement. And the actual term Night of the Long Knives, that refers back to the Saxons murdering the Welsh. That's why it was referred to as Night of the Long Knives, when the Welsh and the Saxons were having a peace meeting, and the Saxons were supposed to not bring any weapons in, and they had knives that were hidden in their boots, and at the certain word, once that was said, they butchered all the princes, the Welsh princes. So that's where this term actually comes from. So this happened at the time, and then there was the violence that was, this defensive violence that was being used by Mosley's bodyguards. So that led to negative publicity. And at the same time, Mosley continued to be accused of anti-Semitism by his opponents, who were hoping to stir up violence against him and his party. So essentially you have groups that are trying to shut down Mosley's speech and prevent him from being able to say the things that he's saying. I don't think he was ever really that anti-Semitic. I don't think he singled out Jews at all as being the source of the problems or his specific opponents. I think he said if Jews support British policies, British ideas, then, you know, that's not an issue. But I think he did say that there might have been Jews that were involved in communism, and because he was against communism, then he was going to be against them. But he wasn't, he didn't specifically speak about Jews in the same way that Adolf Hitler, for instance, spoke about Jews. And clearly Adolf Hitler didn't call for the gassing of Jews. There's nothing like that in Mein Kampf. But he did talk about Jews in a negative way. And I don't think Mosley ever really did that.
Mostly didn't initially talk about Jews at all, but what he then found was that there were, amongst the communist groups that were attacking his meetings, there was a very high proportion of the communists that were Jews, and also there was an organization which I think was called either the 43 group or the 42 group, I can't quite remember which, which was a group of Jewish ex-servicemen who then targeted Mosley's meetings, and who this would have been after the Second World War. So, but I would imagine a similar sort of situation would have existed beforehand, where there were Jewish groups that were just attacking his meetings because they viewed him as being anti-multiculturalism, and therefore opposed to Jewish organisations in this country.
Yeah, I think it was the 42 group. We did a series of interviews at Radio Alban a while back with an old nationalist called Mr. Rye, who was in his 90s. And he was talking about this in this 42 group, and a fellow called Geoffrey Ham, who was part of the British Union of Fascists. And he got very, very badly beaten up by this group. He said that they were effectively terrorists. They would use razor blades, baseball bats, cudgels, you know, all these horrific weapons against people simply for being a part of Mosley's party or for supporting Mosley. And there's a book out today which lionizes these people that were carrying out these essentially terrorist actions against Mosley.
William Joyce, that you've mentioned earlier on, Lord Hawhor, he was attacked by the same group that used a razor and actually cut his mouth from the corner of his mouth all the way through to his ear. So he had like a very sort of pronounced scar across his cheek forever after that. And that was one of the things that made William Joyce then become more anti-Semitic afterwards as a result of having suffered that injury.
Horrific violence against people just for having a different opinion, just saying, well, we cannot allow you to speak your opinion. It effectively says that, you know, they had no counter argument to it. If you've reduced to using violence, it's because you've got no counter argument. Surely they could have, you know, created an argument if it was possible to. So the fact that they resorted to violence, it really says to me that, you know, they had no counter argument to what Mosley was saying. We have an interesting quote here, which is from Wikipedia, and it's supposedly an example of Mosley's anti-Semitism. And it says, in April 1935, he said, "For the first time, I openly and publicly challenge the Jewish interests of this country, commanding commerce, commanding the press, commanding the cinema, dominating the City of London, killing industry with their sweatshops. These great interests are not intimidating and will not intimidate the fascist movements of the modern age." And Wikipedia just sort of puts that there as an example of his anti-Semitism, but it doesn't actually say what the actual challenge was. And he's specifically challenging the Jewish interests that are involved in commerce, the press, the cinema, and he's challenging them about something, but it doesn't tell us what the challenge is. Simply the fact that he is asking the Jews about something is considered to be anti-Semitism, which I found rather interesting. I really would like to have known what he was challenging them about, what the question was that he was asking them. But it just doesn't tell us. You know, it's like if you question the Jews about anything, then that's considered to be anti-Semitism, is effectively what it is saying there. And the party was unable to fight the 1935 general election. And it doesn't say why that was, but it says that they were unable to fight the 1935 general election. Perhaps they had problems with the election committee getting registered as a party or something like that. Any ideas, Max, why they were unable to fight this election?
No, I can't think what the reason was for that, to be honest, off the top of my head.
Yeah, back in 1935 there. Next, we'll have a look at his marriage. In 1924, Lady Asynthony Curzon joined the Labour Party and was elected as the Labour MP for Stoke-on-Trent in 1929. And she later joined Oswald's new party and lost the 1931 election in Stoke with him. She died in 1933 at 34 after an operation for peritonitis following acute appendicitis in London. So his first wife died at an early age. After this, Mosley married his mistress, Diana Guinness, née Mitford, born 1910, died 2003. They married in secret in National Socialist Germany on the 6th of October 1936 in the Berlin home of Germany's Minister of Public Entertainment and Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, and Adolf Hitler was their guest of honour. And Diana Mitford, obviously her sister was Valkyrie Mitford, wasn't she? Who was fascinated by Adolf Hitler and ended
up... I think you're thinking of Unity Mitford.
Yeah, Unity Mitford. That's it. Unity Valkyrie Mitford. That's what she calls herself. She called herself Valkyrie in the middle of her name. So that was his wife's sister. Because I think there was three of them, weren't there? There was one that supported National Socialism, one that supported Communism, and I think one that married Mosley. He spent large amounts of his private fortune on the British Union of Fascists and tried to establish it on a firm financial footing by various means, including an attempt to negotiate through Diana with Hitler for permission to broadcast commercial radio to Britain from Germany. And Mosley reportedly made a deal in 1937 with Francis Beaumont, the heir to the seigniorage of Sark, to set up a privately owned radio station on Sark. So he understood the importance of propaganda there and wanted to set up a radio station in Germany so that they could be heard by the people in Britain. And I guess that's what William Joyce ended up doing during the war. Because I guess it must have been difficult to actually set up a radio station and broadcast it at this time without the aid of the state. Because we had private radio, didn't we, by the time we get to the 60s. We had pirate radio on ships that were set up in the sea. I forget what the names of them were, but we had various pirate radio that was set up on ships in the sea. So at this time, it must have been that you had to have a state involved. And I guess once the war started, obviously Mosley didn't want there to be a war. But once the war started, these connections with Germany would have stopped. Do you know much else about Oswald Mosley at this time with Germany before the war, Max?
I haven't got a lot of detail here. Sark though is one of the Channel Islands, isn't it?
Yeah, Guernsey, Jersey, and Sark. And he spent a large part of his private fortune on the British Union of Fascists and tried to establish it on a firm financial footing. So obviously he's putting his money where his mouth is there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there was the period then when once the Second World War broken out, where the Regulation 18B was introduced, which then meant that Mosley and all of the people who were prominent within the British Union Fascists were turned into in prisons or what you could loosely describe as concentration camps.
Yeah, we got a fair bit of detail to get into that, and also Cable Street and what happened at Cable Street, and I think we'll get into that in the next episode rather than starting that now, Max. So we'll leave that here. So thank you very much for coming on today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.